Welcome to the Plant Cunning Podcast,
where we explore our relationship to plants, other people, and the mysteries of nature.
Coming to you from the High Allegheny Plateau in central New York,
we are your hosts, A.C. Staubel
and Isaac Hill.
Today on the Plant Cunning Podcast, we have Jason Miller, and Jason is a sorcerer, an author, and an educator. He's written some wonderful books, he has some wonderful classes, including The Sorcery of Hecate and Strategic Sorcery. Those are some of his more popular classes, as well as books including Financial Sorcery and Protection Reversal Magic, which is going to be the main book we're going to talk about today. And this was your first book, Jason, but also your latest.
It is the first and the last, the alpha and the omega. Yeah, so it was my very first book. It was asked for by New Page Press, who I published with, and then they got bought up by Wiser. And Wiser approached me last year and said, we want to do new versions of your first two books. And can you add 5,000 words of stuff to them? And there's a couple of ways that can go. And it's really odd, because at first I was like, yeah, I'd love to. And then it's kind of like somebody handing you your 10th grade homework back and like, would you like to say anything more? It's like, well, no. This was yeah. Done. I put this to bed. So on the one hand, people have loved the book. And it's definitely one of the best-selling books for me. So I didn't want to mess with it too much, because, I don't try to fix what works. So I didn't want to get in there and just reshape it or anything like that. I wanted to keep the essential book. So then it becomes like, do I drop little tidbits in almost like internet windows? Like, beep, by the way. And I decided to just do a new intro and then add a little thing at the end of each chapter to say, so basically give me a chance to argue with myself, right? Like, yeah. This is what nice. 2006 Jason thought, and God, he was stupid, because 2023 Jason knows. And 2043 Jason will probably think something entirely different. But yeah, so it is my oldest and my newest book. So yeah. That's and as it turned out, I did have kind of a message shift to provide in the new material, like a tone I wanted to help people reach.
Yeah. And I really liked it. It's kind of like a commentary, like you're giving a commentary on your book.
Yeah, I like that style. I think you made a good choice there to just add the additions to each chapter at the end.
Yeah, it is. And it maybe it's just that as a teacher now, I'm more exposed to more people than I was back then. But I really, I was writing and teaching and active online before I wrote the book. And in the Western occult scene, a lot of psychic attack got dismissed. It was really like, oh, you're
right. Back in the day.
Yeah, one of these people that just imagines things, and this isn't how it really is. And oh, if you would find things in books, like if somebody were able to perform a psychic attack, they would be spiritually evolved enough not to want to. I'm like, nah, it's like saying if somebody, wanted to stab someone with a knife, they would first have to learn to perform a tracheotomy with it, and therefore they would never just stab someone, because anyone that could learn surgery would be, past all that. It's just not true. And so when I wrote the book, I was sort of like, look, this happens, and these are some of the best-selling supplies, and ceremonial magic is not the only effective magic out there. People have been doing magic very simply for forever.
Yeah.
And so no, one does not have to be a member of a magical order and have 777 memorized or things to be able to do magic. This is a fallacy. And then the book came out, and I, people overall did start to take it more seriously. And I think the Western occult scene started to wake up from its like Crowley golden dawn haze and look around at the rest of the world and be like, oh yeah, like people have been doing magic all along without all this, without, you know, outside of that little sphere. And oh yeah, they do curse. And now, partly because of that, partly because of the internet and the way it just kind of, I mean, I'm old. I personally think it just breaks people's minds at this point. It's the age of information is now the age of misinformation.
Much.
Endless information.
Yeah, we just know too many things, or think we know too many things even.
Right. And you can cherry pick because there's so much information. You just grab what you want that supports your your hope or your fear, right?
Yeah.
And so you'll see things. I mean, I remember one day somebody was like, oh, it's a new moon. I went to Hecate for a spell of protection. And then I woke up and I felt a chill in my room. Somebody please help me. Why does she want me dead? And, you know, immediately there's like 20 hero figures jumping online. Like, I can save you from this dark goddess that wants you dead. And, you know, when I jumped on and I'm like, yeah, no, that like, this is not a thing. You're imagining, or you're letting a small single incidence of something odd kind of paint you a full picture. And then everybody was like, I thought you believed in magic, Jason. And I'm like, yeah, I do. Like, I believe that there are violent people out there, right? Like, I believe, just like spirits, I believe that there are people who do harm, that some who do harm with no reason, most who do harm with some kind of motive, right?
Yeah.
I think it's rare that people are just like walking around punching people in the face for no reason. And I'm like, but this is a case of like, he went to Hecate on a time that's sacred, doing something that's within her wheelhouse. I'm like, you know, this is the equivalent of me going to Starbucks, ordering a coffee, and the barista hitting me upside the head with a coffee pot, trying to kill me with it. Like, it just doesn't, it doesn't happen. But it's very difficult to talk sense. So I tried the best I could in this dynamic tension between old Jason and new Jason talking in the book to establish, like, it's real, take it seriously, but really read that chapter on symptoms, because it's not just one thing that you declare, I am under psychic attack, you know?
Right.
Yeah, it's probably going to be a few different signs that make it actually more real. So how would you distinguish? I know it's a whole chapter and it's a whole topic, but how would you distinguish it?
I mean, really what you're looking for is, first of all, a constellation of symptoms, right? Mm-hmm. And the symptoms really should be unusual.
Yeah. Right?
So if you, like in 2008, 2009, I would run into people that had lost their jobs. And they're like, I must be cursed. I can't find a job. And I've never had this much trouble finding a job. Like, yes, it's called, you know, an economic crisis that we've never seen in our lifetime. So this is not unusual, right? Now, the cool thing is you can do a cleansing, right? At any time. If you just want to cover your bases and just be like, you know what? I'm gonna do a cleansing bath. I'm going to roto-root myself and my space. That's never a bad idea, right? Basic protection. Right? Like making sure the alarm on the house works, right? Like basic stuff. Hey, you know, I've been lax in my regular rituals of gatekeeping more than, you know, armor. Let me get on that, right? Hey, no problem. So you don't even need to know. You can just say, okay, well, maybe there's something and I can do a little something and walk away. It's really when there's, oh my God, you know, I lost my job. My wife is packing up to leave. Things are breaking in my hands. And I just called like a bunch of people online frauds and, you know, or I, you know, I've done something to really piss off someone that practices magic. Or, you know, it's not always a person. It can be from a spirit as well, you know, or I just traipsed through this sacred area that people know as a sacred area and decided to take a huge shit in the, you know, in the sacred pond. Then,
right.
Yeah.
You know, there, you know, so is there reason? Is there motive? Is there a constellation of symptoms? And then you can sort of put up the extra protection, right? And even then, it's not like, I think it you should know that you need extra protection. Like, that's not normal. I liken it to driving, right? Like, do you guys drive?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You live in the country. I live in the country. So we live and die by our vehicles.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, I get in the truck, which has an airbag, and I put on my belt. I do not put on a helmet and a 5-point harness, and there's no roll cage, right?
Right.
If I was going to get into a stock car race, I would absolutely have that on.
Right.
So if you think you might be, then okay, you know, it hampers your style a little bit, right? To have to have that type of protection. You have to Dukes of Hazzard it out of the car because your door is welded shut. People are probably too young to remember the Dukes of Hazzard, and you know,
I remember.
I probably shouldn't even bring it up because they had a big General Lee on top of their car, which is terrible. So you know, let me just clarify that that's not an endorsement of
right.
of that in any way, shape, or form, just to show everyone grew up on. But yeah, you know, they have to go in through their window. So the more protection you have, it does hamper your movement. It hampers your ability to communicate with spirits. If you're spending all day every day just like, I'm gonna hide in my castle, nothing can come in here, I've got pentagrams and hexagrams and rose crosses and septagrams drawn in my sphere, nothing can get in, and then you sit and you're like, you know, I'm opening myself up to the spirits and I'm not hearing anything. I don't know why. So yeah, too much protection is, you know, you want to avoid unless you really need it.
Yeah. You don't want to walk around with a suit of armor on all the time necessarily.
Yes, I call it the Excalibur problem. You remember another 80s movie, Excalibur, right?
Mm-hmm.
Everybody wore these huge sets of jousting armor, and they wore them everywhere. They wore them to dinner. They wore them to bed. They, you know,
yeah.
Like Helen Mirren's and God, who was the other guy? Well, anyway, you know, they're all wearing this ridiculous armor, even for sex scenes. It's just like, guys, come on. Like, it's kind of hurt.
Yeah. I think another thing that's important here is divination. And that's one of the, I mean, you've got like several things that you should do every day, and in different systems, different traditions, they have other things that you should do every day. In the tradition I learned mainly, I mean, we were supposed to do banishing rituals, meditation, and then divination. But I found that divination is very, this is one of the things that divination excels in, is finding out whether or not you actually are being attacked or not. And like horary astrology is really good for this, but even just tarot or the runes. But how? In the right hands, yeah.
You're very good at this. However, I can tell you that they're not always in the right hands.
Yeah.
And so the problem with divination and using that as, and I'm not arguing with you, by the way. Like, I would use divination. Don't get me wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I would also consult some people that I think are level-headed and do not have a vested interest. Because you've got a couple things. One, you've got people that are divining and they see something wrong, right? A negative card came up, that's it. You're cursed. You're and it's like, whose life is perfect, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Right. It doesn't mean you're cursed. But people also love to go into, you know, they love to feed emotion.
Yeah.
It's also a lot easier if you're divining for a stranger or even a casual acquaintance to say, yes, I confirm your belief. Challenging their belief is difficult. Now, if you're a close friend, I think your duty is to kind of call people and their crap, right? It's like part of being a close friend is occasionally just being like, yeah, listen, no, you're, you know.
Someone's got to do it.
Yes, come back off the edge. But you've got people, they want the psychic soap opera, right? And it's on both sides. You've got the people on the other side, on the diviner side, they love the psychic soap opera because now they're the hero.
Right.
And you've got people on the other side that love the psychic soap opera because it kind of gives two things at once. It feeds two things at once. One, you're incredibly important because no one would be cursing you if you weren't important. And two, you're not responsible for anything that's going on at all because you're being cursed.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Life's a mess. It's got nothing to do with you. It's somebody else doing it.
Yeah. So
it's hard to kind of give people that, like, well, be careful of this kind of thinking without them thinking like, well, Jason then hates divination and doesn't think anyone's under psychic attack, because that's not true. Yeah. Right? These are just things to keep in mind that we're not feeding. And unfortunately, because I am an author and a teacher, I would say at least twice a year, people come to me saying that someone divined that I am attacking them. Right?
That you are attacking them.
Yeah, that I am attacking them. And why am I doing this? And you know, could I stop? Or they're going to come after me. And, you know, because they know that I'm after them and I'm gunning for them. And I can tell you that 9 times out of 10, my response to this is, who are you? Like, not only am I not cursing you, I don't even know who you are.
Yeah.
And then sometimes it is people, I've never been this person. Like, I've never cursed any of these people. Mm-hmm. But cards, divination have said that I have. So
if
we lived in a world where divination was that solid, but it really depends on whose hands it's in.
Yeah. Mm. That's one of the reasons I like horary astrology, because it's a little bit more cut and dry. And there are like specific rules for if it's a psychic attack or not. But you have to have a skilled practitioner to do it. And I think that's one of the other things too, is going to, I mean, it's good to divine for yourself, but also going to somebody who's more objective can be helpful.
Mm, totally.
And someone who is not then in the position to charge you for protection, right?
Right.
That's the old scam. I mean, the gypsy witch cards that I think everyone remembers seeing at some point, the orange pack with the Halloween witch on them, that was a deck of Sibylla-like cards that was more or less designed to give bad readings. It was, you know, the amount of negative cards is like way more than good cards. So there have been those that have argued, well, it's there to give people the impression that they need help, which the reader will provide, which is much more, you know, yes, the reading is $10. The curse removal is $200.
Yeah.
Right. And again, I have nothing. I used to do magic for money myself. I have nothing against charging magic, you know, money for magic. It's your time and your effort.
Your knowledge and skill. Yeah.
Right. So, but like anything else, just the fact that there's frauds doesn't invalidate the real thing. And the evidence of the real thing doesn't invalidate the idea that there might be frauds or bad actors. So with divination, we have to be careful. Another sign is if people go to multiple readers, because if I think I'm cursed and I go to you for a horary reading and you tell me no, chances are I'm not walking away. I'm going to go to you and say, can you give me a card reading? And until somebody tells me I'm cursed, it's like the person that goes to the doctor, like, well, they didn't find anything wrong with me. And sometimes, you know, it is the doctor being completely ignorant of something. But magic is like any other real thing. And since doctors can be wrong, lawyers can be wrong, weathermen can be wrong, economists are often wrong, you know, in all these fields that are real and socially accepted, people make wrong interpretations, wrong predictions, and miss things. Sometimes people who make their living divining have been like, you know, well, if you don't think I'm right 100% of the time, you must not really believe in divination. And I'm like, no, it's because I believe divination is real that I'm pretty sure you're not right 100% of the time, because things don't work like that in the real world.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Multiple of my astrology teachers have different traditions have both said, if you're reading at 80% correct, then that's 100%.
Right. Yeah. 80% is a great number to shoot for. So there again, we've got the 20% possibility of a wrong interpretation. And then, like I said, people will bounce from reader to reader. And as the protection and reversal magic guy, I have often had people tell me, well, look, I got a reading from this person and they said that a Peruvian shaman that I took a class with at the local occult store is burning candles against me every night. And then I went to another reader to confirm this. And you know what they told me? They told me that this person I was in a coven with in high school is burning candles against me every night. And then I went to another person to confirm, and they told me that my mother has summoned goetic demons to, you know, every night. And rather than think maybe one or all three people are wrong, they think, so I need help because a Peruvian shaman, my high school friend, and my mother are all trying to kill me. And it's like, no, like just no, start fresh, no. And so these are the kinds of problems. Yet we have to navigate this without dismissing it entirely. Or even mostly, we can't get into this mindset of, well, only 1% perhaps, because I don't think that's accurate. It might be 10 to 20%, right? That are really under some kind of curse or crossed condition, which is a lot, right?
Yeah.
But it's still a whole lot more that are not.
Yeah.
And like something's probably going on with that person if they think that three different people in their lives are cursing them, like something's out of balance. And so maybe the focus should be on like restoring relationships and restoring balance in the life. And you mentioned doing simple things every day, like a ritual, like, you know, every day you do a ritual bath, but that's an example of something that is in your control that you can do. So what are some other ways that you can protect yourself on the daily, you know, whether it's a banishing ritual or just, you know, grounding down? Like, what do you do on a daily to keep your space and yourself clean?
I have, like you, grown up in a tradition where banishing every day was recommended.
Yeah.
And then I kind of stepped away from it. And I realized, well, in most of the world, banishing things on a daily basis is not a thing.
Yeah.
Right? And so when I stepped away from that, I started to succeed a lot more with spirit contact and generally what I put out into the world rather than what I keep out of my world.
Mm-hmm.
And so you build on that, right? What are your, which is why in the new book, I think I have a habit of forgetting what I wrote, but I think I said, you know, hey, maybe instead of banishing as a regular, how about, you know, devotion or spirit, you know, something
offerings.
Like that,
right.
Spiritual authority.
Yeah.
That's so much better than banishing. Why? Because you're still out in the world, but now spirits can pick up and you can call upon these powers that you're devoted to, that you have a spiritual connection with, that have your back, as opposed to putting up a wall, right? Like, one of these is the banishing ritual, like you're the boy in the bubble. Mm-hmm. Again, an 80s movie, John Travolta.
Yeah.
I didn't even mean to bring that one up, but I am definitely a man of a certain age. But, you know, you don't want to be in this bubble of like nothing can get in. You want to be out there. So isn't it better to be known as somebody who is, I mean, think about it. If somebody is a cop, right? They could be the scrawniest, nastiest person in the world, but I'm not going to pop them in the nose at the bar because they're a cop, right? Like, it's, you're just, you know that other cops are going to hassle you. You're going to find yourself pulled over at best, right?
Yeah.
So you don't do it. So devotion, and not like Christian, oh, I am so small, and you, I mean just regular contact, making offerings on a regular basis. Kind of the opposite of what Victorian occultists would say. They would say, you know, stay away from those local beings. You don't know what those spirits are. They might, you know, they're just the hoi polloi in your neighborhood. Stick to these beings in the grimoire. They're, you know, we know who they are. Mm-hmm. And then you look in the grimoire and they're like, you know, to contact them, you must have a ring. They must be in a triangle. They must be bound and gagged. And it's like, that's a little, you know, why do I want to contact this being again? Why can't I talk to my neighbor? Right. So get in good with the neighbors, get in good with the locals, right? Like, be part of your spiritual community as well as your magical community, right? And then build connections to divine powers and to powerful guardian spirits. And again, it's not, most of this can be done through offering, through rituals. It's not, it doesn't even have to be prayer. In the Sorcery of Hecate course, we do it through constant exposure and applied mantric working, right? So there's different mantras that we use to connect and build, and we use them in a particular energetic way. We don't, it's not just repeating something over and over. Amulets, right? Having and something on you that you've charged is like, this is protection, right? It's on me, and now I don't have to think about it, right? It's just there. It's like the airbag in your car. You don't think about the airbag until it goes off. So things like that. These are the things that we can do on a daily basis. Because, you know, when going back to something you said earlier, you have these people that, you know, they might come off as disturbed. And they might be disturbed, which is why they're thinking they're under attack. On the other hand, they might be disturbed because they are under attack. That too can be one of the symptoms. Now, if they have no history of, you know, neurotic behavior or something like that, and then all of a sudden they're a complete, you know, mental breakdown mess, that's a symptom.
Right.
If it's a person that struggled with, you know, anxiety attacks and crippling depression their whole life and it comes back, it's not necessarily a symptom. At least it could be, just not by itself. You would need to look for other things as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tough, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's the thing I keep telling my students is like, it's the magic is real.
Yeah.
Real things aren't easy. They're not cut and dry. They're not black and white.
Nuanced. And they're complex. They're nuanced. Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of the community is like, yeah, magic is real. And then they forget how real things work. Right? They want it to work the way it works on a show or the way it works.
Harry Potter.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's so many
magical shows.
Yeah.
Like, we've been Netflix binging recently, and just like every show is about some student of some occult school right now. It's crazy.
I have burned out on it, actually.
It's too much.
My go-to started to be like spy shows and things like that. Because you're right. Yeah. I was getting, and I think I've always liked supernatural shows where there's like one or two supernatural elements.
Yeah.
A world of wizards, vampires, and witches at war secretly. It's like,
yeah.
Well, yeah, like it gives you unrealistic expectations.
Yeah, right.
And then, like, there's always some special hero or heroine who is like the special powers.
Like,
you know, yeah. You know, there's some prophecy about them, and you know, yeah. it's kind of
old funny. Hat.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Although, you know, I read the first book in the series is very good, and then it kind of turns into teen romance generic. But there's a book out, oh God, now I can't remember that. Not Enclaves. It's set in the Scholomance. And so this magic school is like the anti-Hogwarts. Like the school wants to kill and eat all the students.
Oh, ooh.
Because magic keeps attracting these monsters. And so to learn magic, they actually created this thing outside, like in a void. And the school basically, like, if half the students make it out alive, that's a win. And they, you know, to do any magic, they have to gather mana. So some of them do exercise all night just to gather mana. Some of them, the rich kids, are part of enclaves that feed them mana, so they don't need to worry about it, right? And then you've got other people that kill secretly, make it look like the students died from, you know, a monster, but they gather the mana that way. And I just thought it was such a brilliant idea, because, you know, in Hogwarts, Harry Potter is just like, leaving all controversy aside, which is not to be dismissed, but you know, all of a sudden he just comes into an infinite amount of money and he goes to Hogwarts and, you know, there's no cost to doing magic. Whereas this, there's mm-hmm. a cost. Mm-hmm. The school wants to eat you. There's a class issue. It's very, very cool. I can't remember the name of the book. But if you look for the Scholomance series.
Okay.
Okay.
Cool.
Has not been turned into a show.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, yet. Yeah. So I wanted to ask a follow-up about, so I feel like more common than maybe somebody specifically hexing someone else, there are people who are just draining to be around who we may love. Maybe it's someone that we're a caretaker for, mm-hmm. or maybe it's a boss that we, you know, can't get out of the relationship of our work environment, but they are just like draining to be around and they might not even realize that they're doing this. So do you have any tips for people who have to engage with folks who are subtle psychic vampires without even realizing it?
Yeah, there are a lot. There are a lot. So, I mean, first of all, there's all, like, definitely people should look at all the mundane things that they can do, boundaries, any kind of self-care around these people. And sometimes people don't like it when I bring up, like, oh, these are the mundane steps. But here's the thing, magic is an influence. Mm-hmm. Right. So give your magic something to influence.
Right.
Right. Like if you walk into a situation, you're like, I'm going to handle this with magic and only magic. Sorry, you're trying to push something uphill. Right. Mm-hmm. Like get the ball rolling and then use your magic to boost it, to make it work better, to overcome the obstacles. So that's the first thing is, you know, definitely do all the things that you need to do to re-energize, to maintain your sovereignty, this is an area where psychic shielding works. And it's something that you can do very quickly. It doesn't require a ritual. If you know, I recommend people practice it in temple. On the meditation cushion, right? Visualize different types of magical shells around themselves. And I've given a couple in the book. but you can have one that is sort of like translucent gray as protective. You can have one that is kind of like flowing colors, almost like oil on water when the sunlight hits it. And that can be confusing. Like that can make that person kind of like, oh, you know, I'm a little off. And then they're not grabbing onto you.
Yeah.
And if you practice this at home and then you link it to a ritual at home, right? Like if you do this just a little bit every day and then you link it to a ritual or to a key name, right? Like Io Heka, Io Ho, you know, Hecate, please help me create this shell around myself. Then when you're in the office, you can recall it, right? And it carries that oomph from the temple into when you're deploying it in the field, right? This is how field and temple magic play off of one another. Another thing that people can do is, of course, back to the amulet, right? The thing that, and now if you know that this person, you can make a targeted amulet. Say, this person, you know, protect me from that dude specifically.
Yeah.
Right. And you can take a little bit of, you know, a business card is not as good as a signature. A signature is not as good as hair or fingernails. So something, the best link you can get, and place it between two seals, right? Two protective seals, wear it under your shirt in a little bag, or even one of those lockets from, you know, the Michaels or another craft store or something like that, you know. So, and you can anoint that with protective oil and so on and so forth. So basically spells along those lines, right? The other thing that you can do is you can get a little proactive about it. You know, you can do a binding without wanting to hurt someone, just to keep them, you know, away from you.
Yeah.
Right. So taking those same kind of personal concerns, putting into a black cloth on which you've written the seal of Solomon, not seal of Solomon, of Saturn. Right. Or if you want to get fancy, you can even get like a little piece of lead and put it in between two pieces of lead. Then what I do is I fold that cloth diagonally, so it makes a triangle. Triangles being, you know, related to Saturn, the number three. Then I keep folding it tighter and tighter and tighter and tighter, and then bind it up. And then I've got a little Saturnian packet, like keep this person in this packet away from me. You're not trying to harm them. You're not even really trying to restrict them in general, just as far as it goes for you.
Yeah.
Right. So and then like everything else, magic is an influence. So sometimes that influence will be fine, but then maybe you'll find yourself thrown into a project with this person where you have to, you know, get more exposure to them. Then you can take that packet and burn it over some Saturnian incense or some binding incense, or, you know, if you're involved in root works, and bend over incense or command, you know, something like that. You can also do something on the other side, or both, where you're boosting your sovereignty, you're boosting your presence. Something like, if we're talking planets, a Helios.
Yeah, right? Sun.
Right? So now this person who is an energy vampire, you can be both something that is too bright for them to really diminish, and also an inexhaustible source of energy. So it can just, it's too much, burn them out. Like that's a little more complicated.
Yeah. I generally prefer that kind of thing. Like doing a sun thing makes a lot of sense to me, because also it's keeping away unwanted influences. It's burning them out. Yes. And it's, you're focused more on yourself than the other person, and like lifting your own vibration, for lack of a better word.
It is. And I always prefer that as well, but you know, no man is an island, and sometimes
Sometimes
you actually have to do the, you know, approach the source of the problem, right? Yeah. Especially if it's affecting other people.
Yeah. So one thing that I did want to get into was traditions and mixing traditions and your traditions. For instance, I think that if you're doing, you know, strictly Golden Dawn magic in a Golden Dawn tradition, and they're saying to do the Lesser Banishing Ritual of the Pentagram, you should do that every day because it's working within a system. And while you're doing that system, you should do that system. But there's also, I mean, there's so many systems, there's so many kinds of magic. And what I find interesting about your approach is that it's eclectic, but it's not shallow, because I find that often there's a lot of eclectic pagans or witches, mages, they just sample too much and they don't go deep into any tradition. Whereas I think the most depth is by going deep, you know, that when you get the real power from going deep into a tradition. So could you talk a little bit about your backgrounds, like what traditions you have gone deep into and how you mix and match them? Because that's a whole other thing too.
Well, you know, it's important to realize that almost every tradition that people encounter is already a mixed and matched tradition.
True. Mm. Yeah, Golden Dawn, for instance.
The Golden Dawn is a big mix and match tradition. And then it becomes sort of solidified, and then people pick it up as a whole and say, well, this is the thing, and now it's a solid thing. But every tradition, no matter how old, is a mixture of other things. This doesn't give us the right to be disrespectful or disregarded or just cherry pick whatever we like. So, you know, for me, I was really lucky. I grew up in an area of New Jersey that is fairly rural, so it's not, you know, northern Jersey. But even though I lived in this podunk town, before the age of 21, I had encountered a root worker named Walter, who was very open and willing to teach me root work, hoodoo processes, also very interested in Solomonic seals and things like that as it interfaces with root work traditions.
Yeah.
I encountered a Rosicrucian teacher who was very knowledgeable about, she wasn't in the Golden Dawn, but she was knowledgeable about Golden Dawn style magics. Mm-hmm. And I then encountered John Mearden Reynolds, who is the first Westerner to be ordained as a Ngakpa, which is like a Tibetan sorcerer priest. Mm-hmm. So I had gotten right from the start this multi-tradition intro. And of course, this is before the internet was widely available, but the books were also, you know, I grabbed Paul Hewson's Mastering Witchcraft and Don Michael Craig's 11 Lessons of Modern Magic and some other books, The Magus from Francis Barrett and so on. So I got this view of these different traditions of magic and how deep they could be with living practitioners to kind of inform what I was reading. But in all cases, again, magic is treated as a real thing.
Yeah.
In other words, it doesn't just work because people believe it works.
Right.
Chaos magic. It works because it works, right? Which means that that tradition holds this thing that works, but it doesn't necessarily only work because of that tradition, right? Yeah. So what I started to find is that rituals from, say, ceremonial magic rituals interfaced quite nicely with some links and powders and processes that I would use from root work to kind of ground that magic and bring it to its target, if you will. Mm-hmm. And it was beautiful, right? But I didn't ever just kind of read a book and then I'm like, well, I got that. I read a book on that. I'm good. And, you know, I always wanted to kind of go deeper into any one thing that I was interested in. So while my view has been syncretic or eclectic or just open, right? Like, I don't think of myself as eclectic if I have Indian food for lunch and Italian food for dinner and, you know, a pork roll, egg and cheese for breakfast.
Right.
Probably think of myself as needing to go on a diet. But, you know, I don't have to be like, oh, well, now let me, you know, and there's no chaos magic kind of mental belief shifting, right? I don't have to be like, okay, now I am Hinduism so that I can enjoy this chicken curry. I'm, you know, invoke Ganesha instead of, you know, none of that. It's all real. It's all there. It's all out there. It's all real. And so since other real things work this way, why not magic? Right. And so you should get to know what these traditions say about these things, because it's information. It's hard won information.
Yeah.
And in some cases, things are very tradition specific, like certain spirits that are guardians of a certain group or a certain tradition. Right. Mm-hmm. And so it's, you know, it gets like every other real thing, it gets complicated and there's no easy answer. So what I did is I learned from people, not just books, in everything that I was interested in. I sought out people that were involved in the OTO. I was lucky because John Meerden Reynolds, apart from being a Nakba, was also involved in the OTO in the 70s and 80s. So introduced me to people in that sphere. And then, you know, found other people that were held interests that I had. So if I became interested in something, I wanted to go deep, right? Like I wanted to dedicate years to it rather than I'm interested in voodoo this month. I'm going to read Milo Rigaud. And then by the time I'm done with that book, I'll be on to something else. No, I was like, let me contact Hungan in Haiti and maybe talk about going to Haiti, and which I was talking about doing before I eventually shifted gears. Hmm. So, you know, I mean, that's really all I can say about it is I try to go deep into any one thing, but don't let it become a prison.
Yeah.
Realize that things are, you know, are good at some things and not good at others. So if I was in the Golden Dawn and I did the LBRP every day for however long, there comes a point after training where you're like, do I need to do this every day? What are the negative impacts of doing this every day? If there's no downside, then it's probably not a real thing, right? Because nothing is only upside.
Right.
So then I have to decide, do I want to keep doing this every day? Do I want to shift? Think about people that know more than one martial art.
Yeah.
Right? If I have a black belt in Taekwondo and I go to a Kung Fu school, the first thing I need to do is not do any Taekwondo, or I'm not going to learn Kung Fu because it's more flowing. It's all different kind of work. It's got a very different basis. But then after I kind of have gained the competency in Kung Fu and Taekwondo, I can probably identify situations where, okay, this hard kick might be the way to go here versus this softer, you know, chin na might be the way to go, you know, in a close combat situation. So it's at that point that people make choices, right? They've gained options, they recognize, but they also recognize that these things don't just work because they're in a tradition. Like if somebody leaves the Shaolin monastery, they don't lose their ability to do Kung Fu.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But so the language of Kung Fu allows you to learn those techniques.
Right. It does. And so it's about whether you are doing an introduction to something, trying to gain competency in something, trying to gain mastery in something, or trying to perfect something. We can only really dedicate our lives to trying to perfect one or two things.
Yeah.
And then maybe there's a thing or two that we've dedicated ourselves to becoming a quote unquote master of. Not that we know everything, but we're recognized as an expert in something, right? Mm-hmm. And then we've got a whole host of things that we gain a core competency with. And that's all we need. That's all we want, right? So thinking about Kung Fu, I think it's great if somebody takes Kung Fu three times a week at their local Kung Fu school. I think it's useful. Gaining a core competency is going to help them with their health. It's going to help them with self-defense. It's going to help them with discipline and a whole bunch of other things. At no point are they the equal to or similar to a Shaolin monk who lives and breathes it every day, right? Right. And they shouldn't think that. But one is going for mastery or perfection. The other one is just, I want a core competency and that's good enough.
Yeah. Yeah. Right? And you have to get that competency before right? you can integrate it with the other things that you're competent
exactly. in. Exactly. If you don't have a core competency, then you shouldn't even be thinking about integrating it, right?
Right.
Like, I need to know how to make a chicken curry before I can make some kind of fusion.
Yeah.
And when did Hecate come into your sphere, and how did that relationship begin? And obviously you use a lot of sort of spells and rituals around Hecate in your books, and you teach classes about it. So how did that relationship start?
Yeah, Hecate became, I mean, I'm only doing this because of you know, Hecate's influence in my life. So it's very odd. A lot of people talk about, you know, this deity showed up and that deity showed up, right? Like, you see this in groups online as if, you know, these deities have nothing better to do than to pop into people's lives on a regular basis. And it always happens to be whatever they're reading. However, it can happen. So twice in my whole life has a deity that I've not been interested in and not done anything with entered into my life. Only twice, and I'm 50 years old. So take that as the, you know, this is not a, you know, something I took lightly.
Well, yeah. And you're also a professional sorcerer and occult right. teacher. So that's even, you know, most people won't even be.
I wasn't then. Uh-huh. So it was 1990, it was somewhere between 1999 and 2000. I was living in Nepal, studying Tibetan Buddhism, becoming a Nakpa myself. And I was at the charnel grounds of Pashupatinath. So if people have, probably more people are familiar with Varanasi, India, where they burn bodies on ghats at the river and then, you know, put them to rest in the Ganges where they float downstream. So Pashupatinath is similar. It's on the Bhagamati River. They burn bodies outdoors. So I was meditating on impermanence under instructions from Khunzang Dorje Rinpoche for 3 days. So for 3 days, I'm sitting here in my robes and identifying with the corpse on the pyre. So I'm imagining that it's me. And I became very well acquainted with what happens to a body as it's cremated under a much lower heat than we use here. Gets you acquainted with the idea of death. But when you meditate for long periods of time, weird stuff happens, especially if you're magically oriented or psychically oriented. Weird things happen. And in Tibetan Buddhism, we call these nyams, right? You mostly let the nyam happen and then ignore it and get back to what you're doing. So at one point, everything just seems to freeze. Like, I can't hear anything. I look around and it's like everybody just left. Like, fast forward, nobody's there anymore. And this woman with twin torches walks up. And she's got a flowing robe. And she doesn't tell me she's Hecate. She just says, you know, you are coming home soon, which was accurate. You know, when you arrive home, offer me a supper. I have something to teach you. And that was that, right? disappeared and back to, you know, and I, my attitude really was like, yeah, whatever. I'm studying Tibetan Buddhism. You're clearly not part of Tibetan Buddhism. So, you know, fuck off, go away. Mm-hmm. So I would sit, I, you know, did my 3 days of meditation. And, but over the course of the next few months, I was coming home, not only in the physical sense of returning to the United States, but I was coming home. In other words, I was deciding that I didn't want to dedicate my life to mastering Tibetan Buddhism. I went over there thinking I would, you know, start devoting the rest of my life to learning it, teaching it, so on and so forth. And while over there, I had, after this happened, I had decided that I really felt called to teach magic in a wider sense, right? Not as part of one tradition, but talking about it as a real thing on the basis of that alone, of reality alone. And so I came back home physically and magically, and I went to the Pine Barrens, to a three-way crossroads, because by that time, of course, I had identified this figure as Hecate. Not hard to, you know, twin torches, Hecate will come up.
Okay.
And so I then, a friend of mine from the OTO helped fill me in on a lot of the basics of Hecate and Orphic hymns and the Hecatean prat, you know, what to offer at a supper. So I went to the New Jersey Pine Barrens, which is a very magical place, just charged with energy and haunting and spirits, and found a three-way crossroads. And I made a supper, said the Orphic hymn, kind of sat back. And that's when Hecate appeared again, but in this very kind of radical form that is obviously influenced by Tantra, by six arms, six legs, you know, three heads, as she often has, but kind of dancing and put together more like a tantric deity. And she said that basically, like, don't get into your head that you're some kind of super special prophet. You're, you know, that ain't it. You happen to know enough about certain types of magic that I can teach what I want. Like, you know about Tibetan Buddhism and Tantra, and you're initiated, and you know a lot of the basics, but you're not clinging to it so tightly that if I tell you something different, you're going to reject it. Mm-hmm. So I can give you this process that I've been working, you know, that I want you to learn and teach. And yeah, so it's like I knew enough, but I wasn't like so dedicated to the one tradition that I couldn't step out of it either. And that,
yeah, I'm going to master it.
Right. Yeah. That was my resume qualification, right?
Okay.
You know, so I then, four other spirits showed up, the four guardians that are in protection and reversal magic. And what then followed was me kind of like, I want to get as much of this as I can and throw it in a book, because this is also like when the European grimoires and the specialty editions were just all the rage, right? Andrew Chumley was printing the Azoetia and then the Grimoire of the Golden Tone bound in toad skin. And I, you know, they were so cool at the time before it just became overdone. And
you're like, this is what we're doing, right?
Yeah. I was like, this is it. It's a book. And she would just say like, it's not a book. It's not a book at all. And it's not going to come like channeled material either. Like, you're not getting it all at once. You've got to take these little tidbits of vision and information and expand them out yourself. Right? Like, you got to work for this. This is you too, not just me. And then you got to bring it back to me. And so I can say thumbs up, thumbs down, partially. So what happened was, you know, 15 years of doing this before I got the green light to teach it.
Mm.
And so it was a long process. Part of it, appeared in Protection and Reversal Magic, just little tidbits from it, which seemed okay. Mm-hmm. And then I taught a few people one-on-one, getting feedback, because I firmly think, you know, something isn't really done until it's taught to another person, because then you get to see it through other people's eyes. Like
a lot that way.
Yeah. Something that works just for me might not work for everybody else.
Right.
So then it came time to be, okay, offer the Sorcery of Hecate course and, you know, teach it this way as a course that takes time and dedication. And thus I started the Sorcery of Hecate course. But before that, I was already teaching the Strategic Sorcery course. So she had already deeply affected my understanding of magic in general. So I was writing and teaching all kinds of things before her specific arcana was ready to go. Mm-hmm. And then once that came, again, it required a different style, of course. It was like, this email course is not going to work. It has to be voice, and you have to be available to answer people's questions.
Yeah.
So yeah. In between every lesson are these long Q&A sessions. And now that the course is quite popular, the sessions can be, you know, 2 to 5 hours, I think was the longest one.
Wow.
So, you know, it's work. That it was going to be work, and she was not wrong.
Yeah.
So that's sort of what happened.
Just so, you know, for people who maybe don't know, like, who is Hecate and why do you, you know, enjoy working with her?
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, to me, she is the goddess of magic par excellence, just absolutely shifting and real, even beyond the traditions she's been associated with, which I think you can look at in history. So if you want to look at the first appearances of Hecate, it's probably around the Theogony, where she is described as a Titan. So she's already an older goddess, right? She's not one of the Olympians. She is described as the daughter of Perseus and sometimes Asteria. So the vast stars and the destruction of the deepest sea, and there are other lineages and so on, but I don't think they're very important. But she sided with the Olympians, so she has the favor of Zeus, right? And she's the key holder, the opener of the ways. She guides people through the underworld. And so the next big appearance of her is guiding Demeter to find Persephone in the underworld, where she was hanging out with Helios, interestingly enough, and then saw Persephone get brought to the underworld, willingly or unwillingly, depending upon the myth. And so she gets known as this figure who is fully transcendent. She can be on the surface, she can go into the underworld, and she has full reign on Olympus as well. Then she gets associated with magic and witchcraft, right? And also protecting people's homes. So while she's still this goddess of liminality and she's invoked in the Greek magical papyri, she's the second most invoked deity in the whole collection, the first being Helios. And there's, of course, a connection mythologically there. Helios is the father of Circe and Aeetes. Aeetes clearly worshipped Hecate and is the father of Medea, who always invoked Hecate as well. So you have Hecate becomes this more fearsome nighttime deity who wanders through cremation grounds. And of course, I encountered her at a
Yes.
And so she wanders the night, wanders through cremation grounds, is offered sacrifices at three-way crossroads, also is associated with four-way crossroads and magic in general and so on. And then even after the rise of Christianity, she gets brought up in the Byzantine occultist demonologist Michael Sellis's books, where they talk about her strophilos and how Thurgis would call upon her to bind demons and so on, right? Mm-hmm. She appears on amulets with Solomon in antiquity, right? So there were people that were already working Solomonic magic with Hecate.
Wow.
And then of course she appears in the Greek magical papyri. And now she is this fully transcendent goddess who is between Hadad and Hadad. So if people know more about like Gnosticism, right? They know about the Pleroma or God, and then they know about the Demiurge, like the God that created the world, and they're separated. Well, Hadad and Hadad are similar, and Hecate can kind of is the fully transcendent wife of each. And she also has rulership over the lowest depths. So, and she never goes away, right? She appears again in Shakespeare, for crying out loud. So she never, ever goes away. She is this goddess of going beyond, right? Mm-hmm. If I had to describe her in a word, it would be beyond, which of course, Heka, right? Hekas, Hekas, Esti Bibeloi, away, away, all profaner, go, go. It's a going beyond, right? So her nature is always one step beyond what people know about her, right? Even at the time of her first written appearance, there's evidence to show she was actually, you know, a Turkish great goddess. So it's, you know, she is this magnificently vast figure who is also extremely personal. So I just, you know, her magic is phenomenal.
It's amazing.
Beautiful ways to describe her. Yeah.
Which is why, you know, I'm not the only person teaching about her. There are so many other really good teachers, by the way. They each have their own different teaching related to her, because she's not like, I don't own her. Nobody can own her.
No. Yeah.
So when I think of Cindy Brannan and Jeff Cullen and Jack Grail and so on and so forth, so many people writing and teaching on Hecate right now. Sarita Dieste, goodness, probably the author of the book. Like, if people wanted to get started with Hecate, her book that she wrote with David Rankine, Hecate Liminal Rites, is probably the one that I would tell people to start with.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Cool. Thank you.
So this has been a really wonderful conversation. And before we wrap up, I just want to kind of like come back to some of the core ideas around protection reversal magic. And I think that like recognizing this balance and trying to stay on this balance between recognizing real psychic and magical attack, and then also not being a hex hypochondriac is very crucial. But making sure that people are doing the mundane things first, and making sure that it actually is a psychic attack. But there are also all of these wonderful things you can do every day, like offerings. And you also said meditation in the book. We didn't really go over that so much.
Big.
I guess really quickly, why meditation?
Well, we don't know anything outside of our own minds. There is nothing that we know, nothing internal or external, as people like to say. This, in a way, this is a false division, because you only know another person. You only know each other through the lens of your own mind. You will walk away from conversations with each other sometimes with an entirely different idea of what happened, which is why everyone who's married wishes they were followed by a stenographer, right? Like, you know, roll it back, roll tape. I want to see what was actually said, right? So we only know things through our own mind. Yes. Meditation is the mind knowing the mind. Like, it's not, which is why it brings clarity, right? And then people will say, but other things bring clarity. I get clarity when I do the LBRP, or I get clarity when I play baseball, or I do clarity when I dance. And that's all true. You get into a state of flow and sometimes even clarity. The difference is meditation is the mind knowing the mind. So if the mind knows the mind, there's nothing else needed. It is sitting in silence with, and there's different types of meditation, of course. Yeah. Some are focused. Mm-hmm. So you know what it is like to be focused, for distractions to arise, and to release yourself from those distractions. This is when people say they're bad at meditation, this is what's happening. But it's actually the most useful thing in the world, right? To recognize when you're distracted, when you are engaging in something you don't want to be engaged in. Then in life, you know, when you're mad at your boss or that energy vampire, you have the wherewithal to recognize you're being emotionally played.
Yeah.
I'm going to step back. I'm going to release. At that point, you can't really dance around or do the LBRP in the office or something like that. So, but meditation, it's the mind knowing the mind. When we're involved with spirits or, you know, and possibly psychic attack or intrusion, we have a sense for what our own mind feels like. And yeah, we sense something else speaking. Even if it's speaking using our mind as sort of its talking board, right? We can sense its presence if we know what our own mind feels like. So it's an important task to do, right? To meditate, to get to know your own mind, to have, and of course, meditation is more than just recognizing distraction and the substance of your own thoughts. It also leads to moments of real clarity. So your lens is becoming a better lens. The lens through which you know everything that you know is becoming a clearer lens, a more HD lens. So that's why I say, you know, meditation, good for everybody.
Yeah, yeah, definitely seems like a good idea to do. And yeah, you can tell, if you know your own mind, at least you can tell when there's outside influences. And also you're more able to drop things that you're doing to yourself.
Yeah.
Or also if there are a lot of psychic attacks, it seems as though having a clear mind and that ability to drop things, you can divert those psychic attacks often, and just, they just skirt by you.
Absolutely. A lot of them are, you know, one of the things that people learn in meditation is that their mind stream, their awareness is different than the contents of their awareness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But we often identify with the contents rather than the thing that the contents are appearing within.
Maybe even more than often.
Right, yeah, right? Like, I'm angry.
Yeah.
As opposed to, I'm experiencing anger. If yeah. saying, like, realizing that you're experiencing anger implies that there's something else of you outside of that anger. There is a vastness. And that anger is there. And maybe it needs to be dealt with, but maybe it doesn't. Maybe it's actually so small, you can just set a plate for it at the table and let it have its say without having it take over the whole thing.
Yeah. And just for clarity, the type of meditation that you recommend, because there are so many different kinds, you know, there's even like discursive meditation where you're thinking about a specific theme, mantras. But you recommend breath on a Padasati?
Yeah, so, you know, I mean, there are so many different types of meditation. I would recommend meditating on the breath. It could be on a Padasati, but it could even be a completely westernized psychological, you know, there are psychiatrists that will teach breath work.
Yeah.
But really, any meditation that is one of two things, either focusing on one thing at the exclusion of others, or resting in clarity. Both Namkhai Norbu and Mother Teresa would call this the difference between meditation and contemplation.
Mm, yeah.
that meditation is the focus of the mind on the breath or a yantra or a mantra or whatever it is. And then as other things arise in the mind stream, you dispel them and you get back to the point of the meditation. This is good because it's mind training discipline, right? Contemplation, which is a little bit more like Dzogchen or Zen. And again, differences in those traditions, right?
Right.
There's similarities or differences between Mahamudra and probably 100 other techniques that are more open. But in these, you are resting the mind and you are being. You are relaxing everything rather than doing things. You are unwinding the mind. In Tibetan, trekchö is the cutting of strings, right? You're cutting the strings. So rather than focusing on the breath, you're just being. You're staring at the sky or at a mirror. And if you're staring at a mirror, what appears in the mirror doesn't affect the surface of the mirror. The mirror could be reflecting flowers. The mirror could be reflecting dog poop. That might make us go, ooh, or ah. But in reality, if we're anchored in the nature of our awareness rather than the content, there we are, right? We're the reflective surface of the mirror. If it's the sky, we are the vast, luminous, and clear nature of the sky. The clouds appear in the sky, other things appear in the sky, just as thoughts and emotions appear in the mind. They don't have to be gotten rid of. You don't have to do anything with them, nor do you have to become fully identified with any one of them. Rest in the nature of your awareness rather than the content. So it's a little bit different. And both types of meditation are important.
So I guess most kinds of actual meditation are helpful, depending on what the person...
You know, kinds are helpful. Meditation is a tricky word because it just means stuff with the mind. So there are some times where people will be like, meditate on this. And what they're telling you to do is think about something. Uh-huh. So that's not really what I mean. And then there are other things where people are like, you know, well, I relax, right? Yeah. It's like relaxation, meditation time, and I'm listening to something that relaxes me. I'm sitting in the tub listening to Enya, and it's so relaxing. But that's not really what I'm talking about either.
No.
So these words in English have a multitude of meanings that, you know, but if what you're doing is either resting in the natural state of your mind or focusing on a single point, then you're meditating or contemplating, and hopefully both.
Cool. Yeah. My teacher suggests doing the concentration first and then the relaxing of the mind.
It's the most often when in traditions where both are taught, that is most, you know, often the way to do it. And the reason is that your mind becomes sharper and better able to apprehend the openness and clarity if you are already used to silencing the mind down to just one thing. Then that one thing can kind of disappear.
Cool. Yeah, so this has been a lot of fun. Oh, you have time for one more thing?
I do.
Awesome. Thank you, Jason.
Because there, you didn't hear talk about sort of like corporate psychic attack. And I think that's one thing that, like, have you read Culiano, Eros and Magic in the Renaissance?
No, I haven't yet.
That's a good one, but he talks about like a lot of the advertisers as debased magicians.
Yeah, it's like psychological manipulation through corporate logos and through advertising and all of this. And
absolutely,
it seems to me also that a lot of people think that they're free from manipulation, and I don't think anybody is, especially people who don't think they are.
No one is free from manipulation, and. It is kind of funny because people do think, like, people have this idea that, like, if they were, I don't know, like, I live in a blue state. If I was born and raised in a red state, people have this idea that, yeah, I'd still be a raging progressive liberal. I'm like, yeah, no, you probably wouldn't. You'd probably be, you know, a deep red conservative, because there's a reason that there are red and blue states. It's because everyone influences each other.
Yeah.
And then some people have really learned to take up the reins of that influence. And you know, we can thank Freud's nephew Bernays for really kind of giving the roadmap for that to Madison Avenue. If anyone has read Bernays's Propaganda, it's just as relevant today as it was when it was written in the 20s. And, you know, the psychic defenses help, especially meditation helps.
Yeah.
Knowing that it's happening helps.
Yeah.
You know, this is, it's like that saying, the greatest trick the devil ever pulled is making you believe he didn't exist, right? Making people think that they're autonomous beings, not affected by hearing a message over and over and over again, is the surest way to make sure that those people are affected by that message.
Yeah.
Right. You kind of have to be aware that, yeah, if I'm getting hit over the head with this, it's almost impossible for me not to be influenced by it. So awareness is the beginning of defense, right? Knowing that this is happening, that there is a constant war for your attention. Yeah. Realizing that this is, that literally the attention economy is a thing, that there are, you know, for the first time in history, people are literally judging their success by how long they capture your attention.
True, yeah.
Which has never really happened before. There's an ex-Google employee, Tristan somebody or other, I can't remember, but he's very active about the ways in which social media does this. And of course, it's no mistake that everything is getting shorter and shorter and shorter form.
Yeah.
Right? Like now everyone is into TikTok.
Yeah.
TikToks are very, very short, much shorter than a tweet or a long Facebook screed or something like that. Those in turn are shorter than books and articles. And, you know, I would gripe about the kids, but there are adults now who can no longer drag themselves through a book, because their attention span has been so compromised. And to a certain degree, you need to be able to swim in this world that we live in, right? So it would be wonderful if parents out there would just be like, yeah, my kids don't get a phone and they don't get social media at all. But then what happens is then they have no friends, and because all their friends are interacting over this medium. So what do? You have to make them aware of the dangers, and it's tough. So, you know, the magic can help. The same kind of magic that you do to protect against magical influence from the psychic vampire or from the binding spell will help against this corporal visual media. But the causes and conditions are there, that it's not enough to just rely on the magic about it.
Yeah.
I always tell people, often think that internal magic, they it's much more effective than external magic, right? Like, oh, I can just do magic to get rid of my addiction or my, you know, because the interior of the mind seems much more malleable and mystical than the exterior. But truthfully, it's easier to cause someone to get into a car accident than it is to just banish away a lifetime of habits.
Yeah.
Most people know that they can't really do a spell to make it snow in July if they're in the Northern Hemisphere, of course, because the causes and conditions aren't there for it to snow. Maybe they can make it a little colder and they can make it rain, but they're not going to get a snowstorm in July. But yet they think, well, I can go in and roto-root my mind. But honestly, the causes and conditions of how we were raised, where we were raised, these imprint and dig those trenches in our brains, those are just as much causes and conditions that magic needs to come up against as the temperature of the area that you live. So yeah, you know, we can, you know, let's say we do a big working to free ourselves of the influence. Mm-hmm. And for a few days we feel free of that influence, but it's not going to last forever. Mm-hmm. And even then it's only going to be partial. It's a holistic working that we need to undertake. And to a certain degree, we're in a losing battle. We need to know that we are going to be influenced by these things, like it or not.
Yeah.
And just kind of be aware of how.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that meditation is very helpful for that, as you said. And it's like with anything, yeah, the causes and conditions are important, and magic can only help, really. It's an influence, as right. you said.
But again, that's a real thing. People, when they hear me say that, they're like, oh, he doesn't really even believe in magic. And I'm like, no, I do. But I believe magic is real and thus works like other real things.
Yeah.
It is an influence at play in a sea of influences.
And you have to use it strategically.
You have to use it strategically. Use your sorcery strategically.
Well, I appreciate all of your influence on my life and on many other people's life through Protection and Reversal Magic and your other books. And I appreciate you taking the time to write this stuff down and to teach this. Like, you don't have to do that, but you're, you know, sharing your wisdom and knowledge with us. So thank you for that, Jason.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, it's been great talking with you.
It was fun being here.
Oh, just one thing. Where should people find you?
Oh, strategicsorcery.net is the place to find me. You'll see my newsletter there, Monday Magic, and that will keep you abreast of everything I do.
Sweet.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Jason. Cheers.
Cheers.
Thanks for having me.